This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Sell It Like Serhant. How to sell more, earn more, and become the ultimate sales machine. Written and read by Ryan Serhant. This book is dedicated to my wife, Amelia, for believing in me from day one. You push me to do more than I ever imagined possible and inspire me to reach higher every day. And to my dad, who instilled in me a ready, set, go mindset and taught me that while there are a lot of things in life that you can't control, how hard you work isn't one of them. Author's note. I've changed some of the names and identifying details throughout this book. I'd also like to add that while I can remember the exact address of every apartment I've ever sold and when I sold it, I can't say that I remember all of the conversations I've had with people with the same freaky level of accuracy. I've attempted to recapture conversations to the extent that my memory allows. Introduction. I started my sales career on Monday, September 15th, 2008. Do you remember that day? That was also the day Lehman Brothers filed for the largest bankruptcy in history, collapsing the subprime mortgage industry and setting the stage for what we now call the Great Recession. Imagine how hard it was for a new salesperson like me, one who lacked confidence, didn't own a suit, and had no idea how to go about making a sale, to sell real estate at that time. As you can imagine, it didn't get off to a great start. In 2009, I made just over $9,000. In 2017, 9 years later, I turned 33 and had done 472 deals, equaling nearly $1 billion in sales. During a global financial crisis in one of the toughest markets in the country, a salesman was born. On Million Dollar Listing New York, I am the very confident guy who wears nice suits, traverses the island of Manhattan with a driver, and closes $2 to $3 million in sales every day. On my reality show, Sell It Like Serhant, I use my sales expertise to transform salespeople who are struggling to sell everything from golf balls to hot tubs into selling machines. But growing up, I was the opposite of the guy you see on TV. My family moved a lot. I was overweight, painfully shy, and socially awkward. I tried every sport ever invented and sucked at every one. Put a ball directly in my hand and I'd drop it. Toss me 1,000 balls and I'd miss every single one. I had zero confidence and was scared of everything. I was so emotional that I earned the nickname Crying Ryan. I felt most comfortable with the theater kids, where it was okay to wear ridiculous costumes and pretend to be someone you weren't. I was the kid home alone on Friday nights, eating Jell-O pudding and watching Nickelodeon in a ruffled blouse. I went through an awkward Shakespeare phase as a kid that led into studying theater in college. After graduation, I moved to New York City to be an actor, me and about a billion other people. And it was only a few years ago that I was an unemployed thespian struggling to make rent in New York City. My dream of being a famous actor was getting crushed along with my self-worth. I made some money here and there from work as a hand model, but it was never enough to cover even the most basic expenses. My credit card was declined at the grocery store, and I'd hand out flyers on the street to get people to sign up for a local gym in exchange for free workouts. Being broke is an awful position to be in, especially in New York City. And I had to find a way to make money unless I wanted to move back home with my parents. It was my first time living on my own, and I wanted to make it work. I could have been the cliched actor waiter, but who wants to miss an audition because of a shift to TGI Fridays? Instead, I got my real estate license so I could work whenever I wanted and my schedule would be my own. I would learn how to rent apartments to people and do a deal or two each month so I could just cover my bills. When I first started, I was a mess. I couldn't sell a thing. Other brokers I worked with were constantly closing deals and I used to kill myself wondering, how are they doing this? And how can I do it? I was tireless. I tried different tactics, and eventually, after years of hard work, I discovered a secret that gave me a huge advantage. I had the most balls in the air. I was never hyper-focused on one ball. I didn't put all of my energy into one sale or one client. I'd go from a closing with one client straight to a showing with another client, and took calls for offers while in the taxi. I didn't live or die by one deal. I never closed a sale and wondered, what now? Because the next deal was already happening. My more balls up approach gave me a big edge, and I quickly became a top seller. Think back to when you were a little kid, and the bulk of your day mainly involved playing with toys. You'd be happily building a Lego tower, then think, I'm over this. I want to play with my race car set now. But mom says you should put one toy away before getting out another. If you don't do it, she'll freak out about the big mess that you just created. You have no discipline. There's no order. We all know kids don't want to put away their toys. Why would they do that when they can be completely surrounded by cool, fun things moving effortlessly from one toy to the next? I will admit to being fairly OCD. I enjoy a clean, neat environment. But the message we are given that one thing must be put perfectly back in order before we even think about touching something else is bad advice. What's wrong with playing with all of the toys while keeping them easily accessible? As we get older, this message of only one thing at a time has been ingrained in our brains. And we go into the business world thinking the same way. We handle one client before moving on to the next. We close one deal before we focus on another. We treat our clients and deals like objects that need to be carefully tucked away on a shelf before we take on more. My sales theory is not about putting your clients away. It's about how to keep them out in front of you, accessible, so that you can manage everything appropriately and yield the same great results. That kid who has learned to organize her toys just right so she can move from one thing to the next with ease, that kid is a great salesperson in the making. She's got the right mindset, and I call that mindset balls up. Footnote. You may have noticed by now that I've used the word balls several times, even in these first few minutes. I just want to say that, yes, I know balls are also testicles. And if that's where your mind goes every time I say balls in this book, well then, laugh your way through the book. End footnote. More balls up means you're surrounded by opportunity and you're taking advantage of those opportunities at the same time. You're making new contacts, gaining great referrals, and maximizing the hours you're awake. Despite what we're taught as kids and in sales to manage one deal at a time, I discovered that it takes just as much time and energy to manage one deal as it does six. Some balls are quick and can be dealt with right away. Sometimes, if you toss a ball up high, that gives you time to handle a few other balls before it drops back down on you. I learned that it is possible to control their flight path, meaning it's possible to manage many balls successfully. So why grab just one ball when you can handle five or more? Go big. Anyone can get lucky and accomplish one huge sale. You sold a $30,000 grand piano or a six-figure rug? That's awesome! But can you do it again tomorrow? What about the day after that? Did you sell anything else? If you want to have a successful sales track record, you must understand that sales is a volume business. It's that simple. If you want to make it, you have to sell more of your product than anyone else. It's not just about one sale. It's about every sale you make. Being the ultimate sales machine isn't as simple as following a bunch of tips and tricks. Anyone can do that. Sometimes to become good salespeople, we must strip apart our old ideas and build ourselves back up into a more productive and more awesome version of who we are. It's about relearning what it means to be a salesperson. You already have what it takes to succeed, and this book is going to help you be more productive and reach your full potential. People ask me all the time, how did you do it? How can I sell as much as you? This is always crazy for me to hear because not long ago, I was the one asking these same exact questions. I know what it feels like to be a salesperson who isn't hitting his mark. In 2009, I wasn't well connected and I hadn't sold anything since I was 8 years old when my brother and I would sell firewood to our neighbors. How was I going to build a sales career from scratch? In this book, I'm going to share stories behind some of my craziest deals and show you how I created a sales career from nothing and then kept going. This book is not my life story. Seriously, I am only 33, and it's not a memoir about selling real estate in New York City. Snore. In Sell It Like Sirhan, I'm sharing all of my trade secrets. What you are listening to is essentially my playbook about how to sell absolutely anything at all. You'll learn how to structure your day to maximize time and keep balls in the air. I'll teach you the art of follow-up and share sales techniques that I've developed over the course of my career, the strategies that have made my team one of the top sales teams in the entire country. And also, you'll learn how to enjoy selling. Selling is fun, no matter what you sell. And a lot of stuff is being sold everywhere, every single day. You might as well be the one selling too. After all, if Kid Ryan, who couldn't walk down the hall at school without being bullied, can now sell $60 million every month, well, actually, $101,861,229 last month, but who's counting, in one of the most competitive markets in the world, then anyone can. Let's get you to the next level together. Deal? Ready, set, go. Chapter 1, The Birth of a Salesman. New York is actually a fairly easy city to navigate. Most of the streets are laid out in a nice, neat, orderly grid. If I drop off my 92-year-old grandmother from Wisconsin in the middle of Times Square, Nana could find her way around with no problem. Downtown Manhattan, anything below 14th Street, is a totally different story. Sure, the West Village is quaint with cobblestones, quiet streets, and federal-style townhouses, but the street layout can make about as much sense as a 4-year-old trying to solve algebra problems. It's weird and confusing. This should explain why one of my first clients, Jessica, was so annoyed with me. Jessica was a 20-something who responded to my ad on Craigslist. That's how new brokers like me found clients in 2008. We placed ads, clients called, and we arranged to meet with them. It's actually very similar to arranging a date with a prostitute. Jessica had a budget of $2,500 a month. She wanted a 2-bedroom she could convert into 3 bedrooms, so she and her 2 roommates, who were both named Jessica, by the way, could fit. I was taking her to an apartment on Morton Street that might be a good fit for her and her mother. Her mother was her guarantor, meaning she was responsible for paying all of the rent if Jessica and the other Jessicas lost their jobs or spent all of their money on designer handbags. Jessica 1 kept handing me her phone because her mom, who was in Michigan, insisted I give her sportscasters play-by-play of the apartment search. We had been wandering around for 20 minutes, which is about a decade in New York City time where everything must move quickly. I knew we were really close by, but I couldn't find the right street. You can be lost in the village even when you know exactly where you are. We were on the corner of Christopher Street and 7th Avenue, but I didn't know which way Morton Street was, and I couldn't afford a Palm Treo or a BlackBerry, the smartphones of the day. The iPhone had just made its debut, but most people didn't have one back then. Every morning, I would print out tiny maps and directions for each of my appointments. I'd fold them up in my pocket so I could refer to them if I needed to. Walking with Jessica, I kept trying to sneak a peek at my map, but I couldn't get a good look without her noticing. I tried to sidetrack her by saying that I was giving her a quick tour of the area. I pointed out the apartment where NBC sitcom Friends was filmed. And I told her Morton Street was just a couple of blocks away. 10 minutes later, it became clear we had circled the block again when we ended up in front of the same newsstand. Between the Mentos and the extensive Snapple selection were newspaper headlines screaming shock words like plunge, crisis, due to a crashing financial market. I was about to face my own mini crisis with Jessica. She had had it. She glared at me like she was whipping me the finger with her eyes. Oh my God. What is wrong with you? She shouted. You shouldn't be allowed to show apartments to humans ever. She stuck out her arm and a taxi screeched to a stop in front of her. She jumped in and sped off, leaving me standing on the street in my cowboy boots, feeling pathetic and lame. What if she was right? I glanced back at the newsstand. The headlines were taunting me. There was a terrible recession. Why was I trying to sell real estate when the economy had fallen to pieces? I was nearly out of money. I felt almost destined to be one of those guys in his parents' basement, playing video games in his underwear and eating yodels. Enter Ben Kennedy. I headed back to the office uptown on 49th and Madison, thinking I couldn't feel any worse. It turned out I could feel way worse, thanks to my arch nemesis, Ben Kennedy. Ben was from the Midwest and barely said a word to anyone around the office, other than the occasional restrained hello. But Ben was a great broker. As I dragged myself back to my desk, I could hear Ben closing another deal, probably his 10th rental deal of the day. While he was bringing in piles of signed leases and earning huge commission checks, I was roaming around the city lost. How did he do it? I had a top-notch education, came from a good family, and was a preppy-looking actor with a gleaming smile. What does he have that I don't? He barely even speaks. My ego couldn't understand it. How was he constantly closing deals when I couldn't rent a single convertible three-bedroom walk-up to Jessica to the third power? I had reached a low point, and I needed to talk to someone. I decided to call my older brother, Jimmy. He was 10 years older than me and had what I deemed a real life. He had a wife and kids and a solid job in finance. Jimmy has always looked out for me. He helped me move to New York City. He was with me when I opened my first bank account, and he showed me how to get a credit card. Surely he could crack the mystery of why Ben Kennedy was killing it and I was broke. I crawled out onto the fire escape with my flip phone and scrolled down to Jimmy's office number. Before he could even say hello, I was on a major rant about quitting, sucking, life sucking, Ben Kennedy sucking, and I work so hard. I continued with my sob story, even with other phones ringing in the background of Jimmy's office, along with the sounds of people doing important things like making money and succeeding at life. My brother was clearly busy, and before I could spit out the words, "I've had it, I'm quit," he cut me off with, "Stop being such a little bitch. You've been working as a real estate agent for 5 minutes. Suck it up. If Ben Kennedy can do it, you can too." Click. Hello? Jimmy? Oh my God. Did he just hang up? Oh, he did. I crawled back in the window just as Ben Kennedy was getting off the phone. He leaned back in his chair with the most satisfied smile on his face, like he had just rented out an entire apartment building or maybe the Empire State Building. I walked straight over to Ben Kennedy's desk. Before I got too nervous, I blurted out, "Hey, Ben, so, how do you rent so many apartments? What do? I'm new to this and trying to figure it all out, and you're awesome. So it would be really great to get a few tips from the best in the biz, buddy." Ben looked me up and down, taking in my cowboy boots, the khakis, and my belt with the oversized and jarringly shiny buckle. This was my nice outfit, by the way. And he said, "Nah, man, I ain't telling you shit." It was the most I ever heard him say. Turning point. Take one. There's no doubt that transforming yourself into a selling machine like the Terminator, but without the violent killings, won't happen overnight. You'll have periods in your career when there are more questions than answers. You won't know how to close every deal, handle every client's issues, or have all the answers for your team. But just take a step, even if it's small, and you'll be closer to it. Don't doubt the magnitude that a small action can ultimately have. No one will hand you a secret formula for success. You will realize what the formula is only after you've created it. Sirhan's secret number one. The secret to your success will be revealed in hindsight. You won't recognize it until you've already lived it. Ben Kennedy wasn't telling me shit. Okay, fine. My reaction could have been, "Ben is such a dick, people suck." I could have decided at that moment to quit real estate. I could have begged my mother to buy me a plane ticket home and left New York City forever. Who needs Manhattan when you could move back home and your parents have all the cable channels and the kitchen is stocked with Oreos and ice cream, my two favorite foods next to Twizzlers, Lucky Charms, and chicken fettuccine Alfredo. But my brother's insult was running through my head on repeat. Was I really working as hard as I thought? I wouldn't say a light bulb went off, but there was a mild flicker. And the light was just bright enough for me to see that, maybe Jimmy was right. Maybe I was a little bitch. I had to stop and think, is this who I want to be? I share a bathroom with 25 people in my apartment building in Koreatown. At night, I stand on a stage located in the basement with my arms up, repeating the line, tick, tock, for 30 consecutive minutes because I've been cast as a clock in a play about Edgar Allan Poe. You know who wasn't playing a clock in a shitty play? Ben Kennedy. That's who. Was this my life? And more importantly, was it the one I wanted? For the first time, I really started to think about what I wanted my life to look like. Did I want to drive used cars, wear Gap khakis, take an occasional Caribbean cruise, and eat out at Outback Steakhouse every Friday? That's a perfectly nice existence. Gap khakis are comfortable, and who wouldn't want to end their week with a plate of Kookaburra wings and a Melbourne porterhouse? Or did I want something different? Did I want a life that was completely unhindered by anything? Limitless possibilities. Expansion in all ways. That sounded a lot better than my current situation of broken in tears. I understood that I had a choice to make. Did I want to be moderately successful? Or did I want to be phenomenally successful? Was I going to be a good broker or the best broker? I looked over at Ben Kennedy. He was on the phone, chuckling merrily with a client. Maybe I did suck as a salesperson right now. But was there any reason I couldn't change that? It didn't matter what made Ben Kennedy so awesome at his job. I didn't need to know the secret to his success. Even if he had leaned over and said, "Okay, Sir Hand, here's how I do it. I only eat orange foods and I dance naked under the full moon because I'm also a witch." How would that have helped me? Ben Kennedy had found the secret to his success, and it was time for me to find my own. I didn't know how to be a great broker, or even one that just wasn't terrible, but it was time for me to take initiative. I had no idea what my first step would be, but I knew I wanted to take one. I never planned on being a salesperson. Footnote. I didn't have an aha moment to launch my career. But while performing Shakespeare in a park, a grassy knoll off the West Side Highway, in the middle of New York City traffic alongside a 75-year-old man playing Father Capulet, who believed this thing was his big break, I will never forget thinking, I do not want this to be my future. I was just happy with each performance that did not end with us all getting run over by a car. End footnote. The day my brother called me out for my terrible attitude and ridiculous expectation that renting apartments would be as easy as selling Girl Scout cookies was a turning point. It was a small but significant moment that I could only see in retrospect. My turning point could easily have been missed. It's not as if I got hit by a bus and thought, "Wow, I've come out of this coma against all odds. I should probably do something amazing with the rest of my life." Don't wait for a dramatic moment to make a move, because it might not come, ever. If you've been planning to be awesome your entire life, now is the time to put a plan into action. Why wait a second longer? Be awesome now. Initiative is my favorite word. It was time for me to make a serious change, but I had no idea what my first steps would be. I went to bed a low-paid hand model in the most expensive city in the world, and woke up the next day as a real estate broker. And guess what? Both of those guys were totally broke. I had no salary, no benefits, and no handbook on how to succeed at the job. I did not magically transform overnight into someone with contacts, money, sales skills, or even good shoes. But there was one difference. I was excited about going to the office. Going to the office used to be a drag, like a punishment I had to endure until some famous director agreed with me that I should be the next Brad Pitt. I'd stop in between apartment showings to check my voicemail. "You have 0 messages." And drink a chai latte at Starbucks until it was time to show another. But the day after the "Jimmy calls Ryan a bitch" incident, going to the office felt like a positive. The office felt like an anchor. I stood taller and my shoulders felt lighter. I sat at my desk in the little office above Burger Heaven, and I couldn't imagine how I would get from point A, selling nothing, to point B, selling everything, but I understood that it would take a lot of hard work and initiative. But wait a minute. It turns out that taking initiative was something I definitely understood. I'd been all about initiative since I arrived in New York City with nothing but a pair of cowboy boots and a bottle of brown hair dye. I started going gray when I was 16. I shared my very first apartment with two roommates from Hamilton College. They were both paralegals looking to go to law school who landed jobs with good law firms, the kind that have about 50 names and require insane work hours. I was pursuing my dream of being an actor. I had no boss. I didn't have the same intense schedule or pressures that my roommates had. But my dad, who had always valued hard work and discipline, reminded me that if I wanted to succeed, I should work harder than my pre-law, Advil-popping, over-caffeinated roommates. I should get up before they did, work later, and dedicate myself fully to the art of acting. It was good advice. There are a lot of actors in New York City. I'm guessing the number of wannabe actors in New York City is about equal to the city's massive rat population. It's not something you really notice, but if you stop and take a look around, you suddenly see they are everywhere. I had to do something. I couldn't just pop into a bodega for a block of tofu and hope the lady in front of me with a giant bag of cat food was actually a casting director and I'd be discovered for the role of first guy killed in Saw 23. I had to take initiative to reach that kind of success. I realized that taking initiative with my acting career led me to some very unexpected places. I got to play an evil biochemist on a soap opera. I got to run over a guy with a car in an indie film. I was in a production of Romeo and Juliet staged along the West Side Highway. And how many people can say they were a hand model? My hands were painted like teapots and dragons to sell phone plans. My hands were all over the world. I was hand famous. Sure, my acting career might not have been the big victory I imagined it would be. Turns out, I'm not Brad Pitt. My success as an actor was never even on par with lesser members of the Baldwin or Culkin dynasties. The closest I ever got to feeling like a famous actor was when I told a bouncer at a club I was Dr. Evan Walsh IV from the soap opera As the World Turns. He let me into the VIP room, but I still couldn't afford the drinks. A few weeks later, my character ended up being murdered by his own grandmother anyway. Sitting at my desk across from the indomitable Ben Kennedy with his stupid haircut, I realized that, sure, our backgrounds were different. We were like kids from the opposite side of the tracks in a John Hughes movie, The Breakfast Club or Pretty in Pink. But maybe what motivated us was actually the same. For each of us, no deals equaled no paycheck, and who knows what that meant for Ben. Maybe it meant he'd have no money to pay his bills or could end up homeless. Or move back to a hometown that only had one traffic light. I had no idea. But like me, Ben didn't seem to want to look back, just forward. And that meant we both needed to make sales. I wanted to stay in New York City, the land where dreams are made amongst the noise and crowds. Moving back to Colorado, where my parents had moved after I went to college, conjured up some frightening images. Me working as a ranch hand, painting a never-ending fence. Then I marry a winsome cowgirl, have a few kids, buy a tractor, maybe get a dog and a few chickens, and then die. I wanted bigger and better things for myself. I wanted to reach my full potential, and that meant doing whatever it would take to stay in New York City. Maybe I had reached my full potential as an actor, but I certainly hadn't reached my full potential as a human being. Landing a role on a soap opera after having auditioned for an internet reality show called In Turn, where I fought to actor death with 12 other co-stars to be the next soap star on As the World Turns, takes initiative. And couldn't I use initiative to jumpstart my career in sales? I thought about how I could take initiative to move my career forward every day. I asked more experienced brokers if I could shadow them for a day or run one of their open houses. I put more ads on Craigslist. I worked to be less shy. Soon, I started to feel less weird about not going to auditions and more excited about selling. It was a slow, steady process. There were occasional bumps, big and small, but I kept going. At first, I was fueled by fear and the scary thoughts of returning home to Colorado a failure. As I started making more deals, my motivation began to shift. It morphed from, I hope I do enough rentals this month so that I can pay rent and buy a new shirt, to, Wow. I just deposited a commission check that will cover my rent for 2 years. What else am I capable of? The hardest thing for me to teach my new sales agents at Team Serhant is how powerful taking initiative really is. It might sound crazy, but those moments when you feel stuck, like you'll never close a sale or get another client again, initiative is like a magical cure-all elixir. Pick up the phone and make a call, send an email, follow up with leads, do something. Taking initiative is like breathing for a salesperson. You cannot survive without it. Take initiative with everything that is put in front of you, and you will experience success every single day. When I got serious about selling real estate, I wanted to succeed, but I felt handicapped by the fact that I wasn't from New York City. I didn't know many people. Who exactly was I going to sell real estate to? And I didn't have the same in-depth knowledge of the different neighborhoods that a native would. After taking initiative, very often self-doubt sets in. But once again, my previous life as an actor ended up being a secret weapon. As an actor, I wasn't fazed by rejection. I was good at reading people, and I could quickly memorize things like facts about buildings. My goofy personality and prematurely gray hair actually won some people over. It doesn't matter if you have a different background than others in your industry. Don't get hindered by self-doubt. Being different can be good. Your skills, whether in the culinary arts, sports, or teaching, add value to your character. If you can manage a class of unruly seventh graders or perform a physical examination on a snake, you can dominate at sales. Who you were before you entered sales matters. Your personality needs to be authentic to you, even if it's quirky. I have very successful team members who tended bar, were in the military, worked in banking, etc. Each of them has a unique body of knowledge and brings their own fresh perspective to their sales practice. Their prior work experience ultimately makes them more interesting and well-rounded people, and it's the same for you. Embrace who you were and think about how your skills can enhance your sales career. I've known I wanted to be successful since I was about 4 years old. Did I have any clue about how I was going to make that happen? None whatsoever. My skill set at that age consisted of a few lame magic tricks and a couple of knock-knock jokes. It turns out that choosing success first and letting the career follow was one of the best things I could have done for myself. It forced me to be open about how that success would come, because it turns out that I wasn't going to have it as an actor. When that dream died, my desire to be successful didn't wither away with it. I was still committed to the idea of success. I just needed to plug into a different route to get there. Most people hit a bump along the way and they think, okay, it's all over for me. But that's not true. If you are committed to being successful no matter what, those bumps don't matter. You've decided on your final destination and you'll do whatever it takes to get there. Serhant secret number 2. Choose success first, no matter what. Then back yourself into a career. Endurance for the win. Every year, over 50,000 runners come from all over the world to participate in the New York City Marathon, as if running 26.2 miles isn't that big of a deal. Do you know what happened to the first guy who ran a marathon? He dropped dead. Okay, so that was in Greece, where it is super hot, and it was in the year 490 BC. There were no running shoes or water bottles for easy hydration. Now, practically anyone can run a marathon with the right preparation. You train carefully, increase your mileage, eat well, and then put your name on a t-shirt in big, glittery letters so when the crowd shouts, "Go Ryan!" you force yourself to keep moving instead of sitting down on the curb and ordering a pizza. With the proper training, it's possible to cross the finish line and live to Instagram about it. But what if, after all that preparation, the race suddenly switched from a marathon to a sprint? You'd be running slowly and steadily, and now for some unexpected reason, you have to hustle like hell to get to the finish line? You start to increase your speed, you're doing it, but wait, stop, never mind. We're going back to the really long and drawn-out race, and good luck to you. Whether you're in sales for an employer or you're an entrepreneur, you know exactly what I'm talking about. There are the crazy long deals stretched out over what feels like years, a humble pilgrimage to the end result. And there are the deals that are lightning quick, where you feel like a genie. You nod and there's a prize. Then there are the ones that switch back and forth, nearly sucking you dry of energy and sanity. Sales requires a tremendous amount of endurance, and training yourself to be ready for any kind of deal will give you a gigantic edge over your competitors. Balls up. Sales is like a race, except no one is going to tell you what kind of race it is until that gun goes off. As you start to sell more, it becomes clear that success is about how hard you work. It's about your endurance. It's about your ability to sustain a lot of balls. The more ads I placed, the more showings I did. The more connections I made, the more I sold. It wasn't like acting. No one ever said, I'm not taking this well-priced, spacious apartment that's perfect for me in every way because I don't like your face. Sales is about the work. Simple as that. The best thing about selling is that you can do whatever you want to increase your stamina, survive the race, and cross the finish line. No one is telling you to punch out. The choice is yours. You decide how hard you want to work and how much money you want to make. No salesperson ever got a call like, hi, this is Pam, you know, from HR. I have to tell you that you sold way too much this month. Your sales were like way over the top and exceeded everyone else's. You're making too much money for this company. Consider this a warning. Am I right? Early in my career, no matter what was thrown at me, I wasn't going to stop. That put me at a competitive advantage over my colleagues. While other brokers were going on vacation in the Hamptons for the weekend, at a movie, out for dinner, or sleeping, I would be hard at work, ready to surge ahead of them. Sales is a crazy race. While they were taking a hot yoga class or eating sushi with friends, I was checking off my to-do list. The 6 rules to more sales. 1. Never hyper-focus on one ball. You do not live or die by one sale. 2. You never wonder what's next because your next deal is already in the works. 3. You are surrounded by opportunity. Making contacts, gaining referrals, generating new business, always reaching for new balls. 4. You know that it takes as much energy to manage one ball as it does 4, 5, or even 6. 5. You control the flight path. You know which balls to handle first, which ones to deal with quickly, and which ones require more time and attention. 6. You don't blindly toss balls in the air. You care about where each one lands. Let fear drive your success. It's 4:53 a.m. on a cold Tuesday morning in December, and I'm trying to decide which cool new headband I should wear to the gym. While I'm debating between the pink and the purple, it becomes harder to ignore the thoughts that are swirling through my head. These thoughts have been known to include, but are not limited to, what if Manhattan blows up? What if Amelia gets mad at me for working too much? What if I fall and shatter my pelvis and can't show apartments? What if I'm pulled in too many directions and my team decides they've all had it? I think I'm getting a cold. Is this a cold? Or is it the flu, like the weird kind you catch from a bird and you die? You know what would be so embarrassing if no one bought my book except my parents? I wake up afraid every day. But my fear is my most powerful source of fuel. It drives me forward unlike anything else. The life I've built for myself, the Sirhan team, 2 TV shows on Bravo, my vlog on YouTube, my beautiful homes, and a wife who is even more beautiful and lovely, looks very different than it did on the day I started my career as a real estate broker. As I mentioned, it was September 15th, 2008, the day Lehman Brothers announced they would file for bankruptcy, triggering the collapse of the world economy. A feeling of uncertainty permeated everything, and it was really hard to feel optimistic about my new job. After I left the office that day, I popped into the food emporium to buy my favorite sources of cheap protein, tofu and yogurt. I gave my credit card to the cashier. A few seconds later, he handed it back. Declined. My heart dropped. I muttered something about getting cash and ran out of the store. I jumped on the subway, sat down, and started to cry. I literally didn't have enough money to buy a container of cheap yogurt. I haven't let myself forget what I felt like that day. Broke and afraid and like I couldn't make it on my own. It lit a fire in me. Every deal I make, every project I go after, and every extra long day I work is to distance myself as far as I can from that moment. Know what your motivation is. Connect with that one thing that motivates you from deep in your core. It can be life-changing. It's not enough to say, I want to be awesome and make a lot of money. Who doesn't want that? Think about what really pushes you to work harder and do better. What motivates you so deeply that it can provide you with that extra boost of power to send your career into overdrive? Don't let what scares you keep you up at night. Make it push you to reach an insane level of success instead. None of this works without confidence. I'm a very confident person, hence the name of my book. It took a long time, but I can say without hesitation that I'm a great salesperson. If I let fear rule over everything, I'd be too scared to make a cold call or have a conversation with a new client. It's that touch of fear that keeps everything in balance. But you can't sit on the confident side of the seesaw forever. You'll get stuck in a routine, and this is the real death of a salesman. It also puts you at risk of becoming an overconfident, arrogant asshole, and that's gross. It's usually after my daily workouts that my confidence surges back. I start to think about the challenges of the day. Coaching a Japanese couple through a co-op interview for a $31 million apartment and dealing with a square footage discrepancy in a $16 million loft in Soho my client is supposed to close on tomorrow. 10 years ago, my biggest problems were making rent and getting into the shower before Jun Woo and Ha Rin used up all the hot water. Their names were printed on a giant smiley face poster that they kept on their door. That's how I remember them. Now, my challenges force me to stretch and be more confident. I have no choice but to figure out the best way to steer my ship forward. The questions, problems, doubts, and fears don't necessarily vanish. They grow along with me. So when I think back to this shit show that was my early career, I'm thankful for what Ben Kennedy did for me. He didn't show me how to rent an apartment, but he showed me what happens when you face your fears head on. You become unstoppable. Every morning after checking my calendar, I'm ready to go. I kiss my sleeping wife goodbye and pop in my earbuds. Just as the elevator door opens, I take a breath, step in, and say my mantra, ready, set, go, knowing I'm ready to face whatever kind of race today throws my way. The Serhant Way. You've made the decision to transform yourself into a selling machine, and that's awesome. Just remember that no one will hand you a roadmap for your own success. Trust me, you're already an amazing salesperson. You just may not know it yet. All the tools you need to succeed in sales are within you. It's just a matter of finding them and putting them to work. Today, use the information in this book to point yourself toward greater success. Decide now that you will take your sales to unimaginable heights. You're already off to a great start because you're now taking more initiative to create change. From now on, initiative will seep from your pores. Don't stop there. Make endurance your middle name. Well, not literally, by outlasting and outselling your competition. And if this all scares you a little bit, so what? Let that fear be the fuel that drives you straight down the path to success. You've got to take initiative. What does that initiative look like to you? Dig deep and find the endurance you need to make it over the finish line. Let your fear push you towards success. Never forget, none of this works without confidence. Chapter 2, The Power of Yes. 2, Desperate Realtor at RyanSerhant.com. From possibly fake at maybe spam.com? R.E. Investment. Dear sirs, I am seeking help to make a big real estate investment in New York City. Please respond if you can help me make this investment. Yours truly, Mr. X of Atlantis. Footnote. I know Atlantis is a made-up place. I'm hiding Mr. X's true identity to avoid getting myself killed. Okay? End footnote. Looking back, this email sounds very spammy. But Mr. X wasn't offering discount Viagra, and he wasn't asking for any help transferring his billions of dollars into America via my personal bank account. This was very early on in my career, and at this point, I was very eager for more balls. So, I answered it. Yes, of course I can help you find an apartment. I had no idea when I hit send that I was putting myself first in line to ride the world's scariest and most outrageous sales roller coaster. I emailed back and forth with Mr. X to get to know him a little bit and get a better sense of what he was looking for. When he said he worked in energy, it was like someone had stabbed me with a sharp red flag that read, "This guy is totally fake or a drug dealer. Run away now." But I didn't. Instead, I did a quick Google search and got just enough evidence to think he was real. Maybe. His name was linked to a very expensive house outside Paris. If he could afford that, there was a chance he was legit, and I could make the biggest sale of my career. I had hope. I was in. I said yes. I had just the right listing, and it was my biggest listing to date. A spectacular 4-bedroom apartment in Midtown with a den and a separate dining room that was listed for $8.5 million. After looking at pictures and a video of the apartment, he offered $8 million. And after some negotiating with the sellers, we agreed to $8.2 million. Done! I couldn't believe it! After months of doing rentals, I had just sold a super expensive apartment over the internet to a guy who cold emailed me. Nothing shady about that whatsoever. I took myself out for a very lavish dinner to celebrate. All I had to do next was get a couple signatures, a deposit, and close the deal, right? And that's when the story of a simple real estate transaction turns into a Michael Bay movie, featuring my career and ego nearly going down in an Armageddon-style explosion of flames. Mr. X vanished. He wasn't answering my calls, emails, or text. I had no idea where he was or how to reach him. I just convinced my sellers to accept an offer from someone who in reality might be a 12-year-old hacker who was laughing at me from his Spider-Man bedroom somewhere in the Midwest. Or maybe he was a pirate. I didn't really know. I was starting to regret ordering that expensive bottle of wine at dinner. Why hadn't I just ordered takeout? The sellers were getting itchy to get the contract signed, and I was increasingly nervous about who I had sold this apartment to. I didn't want to let my sellers down. I had made a personal commitment to them. As a salesman, your word is your bond. Telling them, "Oh, sorry, turns out that the buyer isn't a wealthy foreigner, but is actually a member of a child-run computer hacking gang," wasn't an option. The truth was, I just wasn't sure. If I was 100% positive the buyer was fake, then I would have to fess up and deal with the consequences. But this buyer was the only one I had, and until I knew for sure he wasn't real, I was going to do everything in my power to make this deal happen. So, I sent a dramatic and somewhat risky email. "I know you spend your time mostly in Atlantis dealing with energy, and you mentioned you have a home in Paris, so I'll be coming through Paris and would love to close this deal if you perhaps have a free second and aren't actually a criminal trying to steal my identity." He wrote back immediately. L-O-L. How's tomorrow? FaceTime matters in sales. Whenever I have a client who is on the fence about a deal or hesitating to move forward, I schedule a face-to-face meeting right away. People often struggle to make decisions, and if they're not in front of you, it's out of sight and out of mind. It's easy to ignore texts and emails, but it's not easy to ignore someone sitting right across from you. I take in-person meetings whenever I can. An in-person meeting shows a client your level of commitment. In the end, you'll also save time, close more sales, and be ready to tackle the next ball. Sirhan's secret number 3. Never underestimate the power of a face-to-face meeting. Sometimes emails and texts are not enough to get a deal closed. Now, did I mention that I didn't really have plans to fly to Paris? I did now. I wanted to show this buyer slash pirate slash drug dealer that I was totally committed to him and closing the deal. I was hungry for this sale. Literally, because I was about to spend my last few thousand dollars flying to Paris to meet with a potential client or criminal. I didn't even pack a bag. I put on a suit and boarded the plane with nothing other than the contract and his alleged address in Paris. I was nervous. Mr. X knew I was coming, but I didn't have an official appointment. When I tried to look up the address, it appeared his office was located in an empty parking lot or behind a French car dealership. Nothing suspicious about that. When I arrived in Paris the next morning after a long, uncomfortable flight, I took a taxi to the address he gave me. It did exist! But don't get too excited. No one was there. And from the looks of the place, it didn't seem like anyone had been there in a long time. I hadn't flown all this way, stuffed between two snoring tourists for nothing, so I sat down on a stoop and waited. And got a macaroon. Then waited some more. Then I decided, hey, I guess I'll get a croissant. I charged my phone somewhere, got another macaroon, waiting, repeat. As the day went on, I started to feel depressed. I just made a total fool of myself. My emotions ran from anger at myself to embarrassment. Why am I so stupid? Then I hit the lowest of lows. I felt truly unworthy of being a broker. Why do all of the other brokers have such an easy time making deals and I don't? As I sat on that stoop feeling sorry for myself, I thought about what I would tell people when I got back. Like, oh, it was a great trip, but he had to run off to Zanzibar to buy an elephant so he couldn't see me. Or maybe I'd go with, his busy pirate schedule of looting ships in international waters prevented us from having dinner. Or worst of all, his mom doesn't let him go out with strangers or buy multi-million dollar apartments because he's actually a child. But then something happened. I got an email with the address of a bar where he was hanging out. He wanted me to meet him there. I felt like I had opened a chocolate bar and found the last golden ticket. He was real. Mr. X turned out to be a fairly normal guy who just happened to be flanked by a team of bodyguards. He had an assistant whose sole job was to bring him espresso. He mostly wanted to chill and drink $700 bottles of vodka, preferably until 3 a.m. That's great, but I was there to get a contract signed, and he didn't even want to talk about it. Mr. X clearly enjoyed watching the preppy guy squirm. It was like a game to him, and he was setting the rules. Will you at least read this if I do another shot? I begged. Not how I normally do business, but what did I have to lose other than my reputation and my career? Just as I was starting to see double, he agreed to read the contract. Why do I need to provide all of this personal information? Do these people in New York not want my cash? He asked. The people in New York definitely wanted his cash. But, like trophy wives, New York wanted that cash on its own terms. After hours of drinking, I was still able to switch on my inner salesman and flip what he viewed as a negative into a positive. I confidently told him, it's standard in New York City. Everyone must fill out the same paperwork. It keeps the city safer. He seemed to buy that, but he didn't sign the contract. It was many shots, and several hours later that I staggered out of that bar with a signed contract in my hand. It was a win, but a temporary one. I got back to New York to find that Mr. X hadn't sent the deposit. A contract without a deposit is essentially a worthless piece of paper. It means nothing. Where was the 10% of the $8.2 million? Was he planning to ship the cash over in bags like in an old Western bank robbery movie? About a million phone calls and several near heart attacks later, I got a call from the lawyer while I was sitting in a taxi stuck in traffic. A wire of $820,000 from Mr. X had just arrived. And breathe. Fast forward to Mr. X's closing. It had been weeks since I'd heard from him, and I was worried that he wasn't going to come through. This ball had been in my pocket for a long time, and I was ready to be finished with it. The day of the closing, I got a text. Meet me at the Mandarin Oriental. Now. Oh my God, he's here in New York City. Amazing. On the other hand, seriously? What a dick. But I made it uptown in record time. Then I sat in the lobby waiting. For an hour. As I waited, I reminded myself that he was making the rules for this deal. And if I played his game, I'd reap a big reward on the other end. Remember, this was my listing. And this was a direct client. So the commission was 6% of $8.2 million. That's $492,000. That was more money than I thought I'd ever make in my entire career, let alone in one deal with a pirate. Sales can mean playing games where you don't get to make the rules. My persistence with Mr. X would only work out if I was able to keep my ego in check and let him lead the way. As salespeople, we must be careful listeners, because clients are always sending messages about what they need and how they want to conduct business. In this case, the disappearing lateness and last-minute text messages said, I am totally in charge. We're doing this on my terms, and I'll sign the papers, send money, and close when I feel like it. This was a game, and if I wanted to win, I needed to go along with it whether I liked it or not. Sure, I could have objected to this way of doing business, but would that have changed anything? It probably would have meant losing the sale, and that was not an option. Never forget that while you're a salesperson, you are also in the service business. And sometimes that means being flexible and playing by someone else's rules. Sirhan's secret number 4. Closing a deal means keeping your ego in check at all times. He finally came to the lobby with an entourage of bodyguards and assistants, and we all piled into a fleet of black SUVs. I felt just like a secret service man, but without a gun, life-saving self-defense skills, or cool sunglasses. We start moving through Manhattan traffic, and it's taking forever. But then, wait a minute, why are we going through the tunnel headed for the highway? The closing is just downtown. All my fears surrounding the shadiness of this deal come flooding back with a vengeance. Are they planning to harvest my organs? Am I being kidnapped? Am I going to be sold as a sex slave? Just as I'm texting my mother about my imminent death, I notice we're at JFK. It's obvious I'm about to be taken hostage. We pull up to a black 747 and Mr. X gets out. A man approaches holding a bottle of champagne and a silver tray. What is happening? Mr. X speaks to the man, signs a piece of paper, and gets back into the car and announces, "Now I am ready to go to the closing." No big deal. He just bought a 747 on his way to the closing. After I regained consciousness and my blood pressure returned to normal, we headed back to Manhattan and closed the biggest deal of my career. Next ball, please. Saying yes equals selling more. Looking back at this story, I admit it does sound bananas. To fly across the ocean to find someone who may or may not exist and get him to sign papers. But in the end, the story isn't about me dropping everything to sit around and drink cafe au lait all day. It's about a deep commitment to closing a deal. No matter how big or how small or how crazy, I will do everything in my power to make a deal happen. And what I didn't understand while I was eating my third croissant was that maybe other brokers only say yes to the easy deals. Maybe that's why I was struggling while other brokers seemed to be moving through deals with little effort. It's easy to say no. It's easy to make excuses about why you can't close a deal. It's much easier to focus on what could go wrong or what the immediate challenges are. But none of that stopped me from saying yes. Sirhan's secret number 5. There will be an objection with almost every single sale. the goal is to turn negatives into positives. Sure, maybe people thought I was crazy to chase down a possible pirate, but you know what?